Justice Hollins, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely, Raymond D. Camillo for the appellee, Verifone Holdings, Inc. It's my pleasure to introduce to the court at this time my friends and colleagues from Sullivan & Cromwell, Robert Sachs, and Laura Oswell. Mr. Sachs has been admitted pro hoc vice, and with the court's permission, will be presenting the argument on behalf of Verifone this morning.
Very well. Welcome to the court.
Good morning, Your Honors. David Jenkins for plaintiff. I'd like to introduce to the court Judy Skolnick and Tom Laughlin from the firm of Scott & Scott in New York. With the court's permission, Ms. Skolnick will be giving the argument this morning.
Very well. Welcome to the court.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning. Before we start, when I start the clock, you'll see your full 20 minutes. When we get to the yellow light, that's the time you've reserved. You can continue speaking, but you'll be using the time you had intended to reserve.
Right. Thank you, Your Honor. The issue on appeal is whether the Court of Chancery's holding that a shareholder who first files a shareholder derivative action has irrevocably made an election and is thereby stripped of his statutory rights under Section 220 to seek books and records of the corporation in which he owns stock. Unless this decision is reversed, Your Honors, the Vice Chancellors will have no discretion to evaluate factors that for at least 15 years have proven to be very important factors in concluding whether a shareholder has a proper purpose under Section 220. For example, to what end will the shareholder use the documents? Will they be used for a derivative action or to amend a derivative action that had been dismissed without prejudice and with leave to amend?
Ms. Skolnick, would you agree that in your California plenary action that the right to take discovery was barred to your client?
No, Your Honor. I would not agree with that.
Then why didn't your client seek discovery in the action which is really what this controversy is all about and what started all of this?
When we filed our first consolidated amended complaint, we believed in good faith that we had sufficient particularized facts to meet the demand futility standard.
Right, and Judge Patel disagreed with you. She dismissed your complaint without prejudice. At that point, you needed to assemble more facts. Why didn't you try to assemble them through the discovery process in your California federal action?
Because there was no complaint pending.
Well, your complaint could have been refiled as it was, and then you could have sought discovery as you did, but in your action, not in the Delaware action.
Well, it could have been refiled and at that point, after it had been refiled, there would have been a complaint validly in action, and at that point, we could have requested discovery, which we did not do because we never reached that point.
Why didn't you do it is the question. We know you didn't. You conceived that you could have, yet you did not. And all I'm asking is why not?
Because, Your Honor, in my opinion, at the time that the case was dismissed with leave to replead, there was no complaint on which to seek discovery.
Yes, you keep on saying that. But shortly after you filed this case, a complaint was on file. You could have then dismissed this case or stayed it and then proceeded to take discovery in California. So I ask you again, without hiding behind the fact that for a period of time there was no complaint on file, why didn't you seek it in California?
I'm not trying to fence with you. We had we filed a complaint after getting the books and records in California, at that point, had we wanted more discovery, we would have sought more discovery. But at the time that we filed in the Court of Chancery, November 5th, there was no complaint pending.
Well, you've given me that answer before. Is that the mantra, or are you going to tell me why I mean, if you had said there was no right to take discovery because of all of the case law that's been cited by the other side, I can understand that. I can understand why the judge in California would suggest that you come to Delaware, and I can understand why you came here. But what you're telling me is you could have gone there, and you didn't. And every time I ask you why not, you say, well, there wasn't a complaint on file. But that's formal. You know, I want to get beyond that.
But it's a timing question. We could have later filed for discovery, or I think we could have requested it, and maybe she would have said the PSLRA does apply, like some judges say, or maybe she would have said the PSLRA does not apply, like some judges say, and would have granted us discovery.
Did the PSLRA apply to derivative actions?
No. By its terms, it does not apply to derivative actions.
So this is not a PSLRA case?
No, it's not.
It's a Rule 23.1 case where there's authority, even under the federal rules, that a derivative complaint has to be sufficient on its own to excuse demand without discovery. Is that right?
There's authority both ways, although the weight of authority says that discovery is discouraged while a motion to dismiss is pending. But, Your Honor, it was a timing question. When we filed this action before the Court of Chancery on November 5th, no, we had no right to discovery. We had absolutely no right to discovery at that time. We did file our amended complaint on December 10th. Pursuant to a previously scheduled order that Judge Patel set up. And that order, there was no complaint when we filed. There was no complaint when the defendants filed their motion to dismiss in this case. There was a complaint on file when the case was argued before Vice Chancellor Strine.
So you're saying with the time that you filed the California action, because of the Rule 23.1 case law, there was no right to take discovery. As an aid to a possible amendment of the complaint?
I'm saying at the time we filed this action, there was no right to discovery because there was no complaint pending.
I'm talking about in California.
In California.
There was no right in California to take discovery.
There was
no aid of a possible amendment to the complaint.
That's correct.
And has that changed? That is that legal obstacle still there?
The legal obstacle, I'm sorry, I don't follow your question, Your Honor.
I understood you to be saying that the federal case law would have been a legal obstacle to your taking discovery in the California action as an aid to possibly amending your complaint when the complaint was challenged under Rule 23.1.
Right. Right.
I understood you to say that that was an obstacle.
That was an obstacle
Did it ever cease to be an obstacle?
Well, the case has been dismissed with prejudice, so it was never.
I'm not talking. What, your California case
was
dismissed with prejudice?
Yes.
Was that the case at the time? Did that happen during the pendency of this case?
That happened in August of 2009. It happened while the case was pending before Your Honors, after Judge Strine denied us any inspection of records.
It was after the judgment in this case?
Yes, it was
But not before?
It was after the judgment in this case, where Judge Patel did mention in her decision denying our case with prejudice, from which we took an appeal that's pending before the Ninth Circuit. But she did mention that we were only partially successful in our books and records. And she, that's the only allusion she made to the books.
Up until August 2009, did the obstacle that precluded discovery in the federal action ever disappear? Was it there throughout the pendency of the California action?
I believe that, well, we never filed for discovery.
I didn't ask you that.
I believe that it would not have served our interest to make a discovery request in federal court.
Why not?
Because when a complaint is been filed and a motion to dismiss is pending on demand futility grounds, I think that the weight of the law is that you don't get discovery to defeat the motion to dismiss. You have filed your complaint, you have made your statement, the defendants have moved to dismiss it, and you don't get discovery to buttress your arguments against the motion to dismiss. But, Your Honors, you do get discovery, or, right, I misstate, you do get an entitlement to Rule 220 books and records once a case has been dismissed without prejudice, with leave to amend, in order to craft an amended complaint. That's been the law in Delaware, and that was the law that Judge Patel was looking at when she said to us.
Okay, so the simple answer to my question is that your understanding was that under the federal case law, there was no right to discovery in order to buttress your complaint against a Rule 23.1 futility attack.
It's correct. When a motion to dismiss is pending, there was no motion to dismiss pending on November 5th. There was no complaint pending. All there was, Your Honors, was an instruction from a federal judge to say, I dismiss this complaint with prejudice, and I'm giving you leave to amend because I think that you were deficient in your pleadings, but I think that you can make particularized allegations that would surmount the demand futility hurdle. I see enough to give you an opportunity to amend under Rule 15A. And that's exactly the position of Noel Sato, of Arlene Ashe, when Chancellor Chandler said, I'm dismissing your complaint. You no longer have a right to discovery. But you do have a right to amend. And what I want you to do is use the tools at hand. Go make your 220 request and see if you can make particularized pleadings that will give you a complaint that will be sustained.
Well, we really wouldn't characterize it as an amendment. It would be a new complaint, wouldn't it?
Well, it's interesting, Your Honor. Under Braddock v. Zimmerman, there was certainly, at the time a complaint is dismissed with or without prejudice, there's no complaint validly an issue under Delaware reasoning. So, and that's why when a plaintiff goes to file an amended complaint in a shareholder derivative case, they have to make a demand of the new board, or they have to consider the constitution of the new board in determining a demand futility if there's a majority of the new directors. So there's no complaint validly an issue. That was our position when we filed our complaint in this case. There was no complaint validly an issue. There is no distinction between the position that we were in and the position of Noel Sato.
I understand that. You know, we spent 12 minutes of your time discussing this, but doesn't it come down to the fact that you filed a complaint that got dismissed without prejudice, and then you wanted to file a subsequent pleading, whether we call it an amended complaint or a new complaint, and you filed a 220 action, as you might, according to the Vice Chancellor, as you probably should have done in the first place. But in any event, you think you should have been able to file the 220 action as encouraged by Judge Patel in order to file the new pleading.
Correct.
And that the fact that your initial complaint was dismissed without prejudice shouldn't have been a bar to a 220 action because it's separate and distinct. We've encouraged people to use the tools at hand. And you weren't going to get discovery anyway to bolster a complaint when there was a motion to dismiss pending.
That's correct. That's correct. And a 220 is not discovery. It has been said quite often. But Judge Patel said you, in her opinion, she wanted us to go to Delaware courts to pursue the 220 because she wanted to see an amended complaint that had used the tools at hand.
So the issue in this case is, once your complaint's dismissed without prejudice, should you still be able to file a 220 action? And to the extent there's any judicial concern, there should be other remedies other than barring the 220 action. For example, not letting the initial plaintiff's lawyer be the lead plaintiff, maybe not letting the initial plaintiff be the class representative. But that's the issue before us, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And there are many other available sanctions if to deter the rush to the courthouse that Vice Chancellor Strine was so concerned with, which we find, if you look at the appendix, it's not supported by the facts. The plaintiffs did not rush to the courthouse in this case willy-nilly without doing any discovery.
Is there any practical difference between if Judge Patel, instead of dismissing without prejudice, had stayed the California action and said, go file your 220 action in Delaware? Is there a practical difference?
I don't think that there should be a practical difference, but there's an intellectual difference which might have a practical effect. If she stated there would be, and did not dismiss, she just stated, there would be an actual complaint pending. And then I could understand the reasoning that there's a complaint pending, go for discovery, or don't go for discovery, but you cannot come to the Delaware Court of Transferee for a 220 because you have filed a complaint that's still pending. Then you get closer to the Beiser kind of case.
So if she had taken that course and said, I'm going to stay this, go file your 220 action, you would expect then that the Court of Chancery would dismiss because it's not a proper purpose.
I think the Court of Chancery would be closer to precedent if the Court of Chancery dismissed and perhaps said if the case were dismissed with prejudice, with leave to amend, then you come within then there is a proper purpose because you have the right to file, absolutely have the right to file an amended complaint. The federal judge gave it to you. And you absolutely have the right to use 220 to craft your proper your second complaint.
Well, isn't this really a matter of form over substance that you're arguing? If the practical consequence is the same, you're just arguing, aren't you, that one format is permissible and another format is not?
I think that it would be it is form. I think it's a cleaner case when there's absolutely no complaint pending. Then there's no question that 220 is available. If there's a complaint with a stay, then you still have the issues of comity where the federal judge says, I want you to use a 220, and the Delaware Court of Chancery should not be closed to a federal plaintiff. If I can make one more argument, because I see that I'm on my rebuttal time, the whipsawing the defendant was one of the points that Vice Chancellor Strine said should never have been done. We should never have forced this defendant to travel cross-country and defend the case in two jurisdictions. Your Honor, we think that that's not very good reasoning. First, it takes the eye off the ball that this is a valid case. There was $400 million in insider trading. There was restatement that was extremely costly. The cost to the corporation was not the plaintiff's litigation. The cost to the corporation was the defendant's wrongful conduct. But in any event, 220 actions are generally brought in the Court of Chancery, and as they should be. And that's why Judge Patel said, go to Delaware. She did not take the 220 herself. She said, go to Delaware. So by its very nature, if you allow a federal shareholder derivative plaintiff to have the same rights as a Delaware plaintiff in Brain and Ash, then you have to, by nature, have a litigation in two jurisdictions. If you're going to go to Delaware to file the 220, which we think is a policy that should be encouraged. And the whipsaw.
Just one quick question. The proper purpose within the meaning of Section 220 that we're relying on in filing the action in Delaware was to develop facts that would enable you to file a buttress complaint, that is, a complaint that would withstand a motion to dismiss.
That's correct.
That was the purpose.
That was the purpose. That was the purpose that we stated. And even though there was a complaint filed while the case was being argued, on December 10th, we did that because if you read the appendix where Judge Patel has oral argument in October of 2009, she says once you get the documents from Delaware, you can amend your complaint before your reply when she's talking about the scheduling. She says, I'm not going to hold argument on this motion to dismiss until April of 2009. You might get some documents from the Chancery Court. If you do, you can file an amended complaint along with your reply. So the fact that there was an amended complaint at the time of oral argument is without any consequence. Vice Chancellor Strine might disagree with that policy of giving a lot of amended complaints as the federal courts tend to give leave to file more amended complaints than the Delaware courts. But that is her prerogative. She set that. She gave us the right to file yet another amended complaint once we get the documents from the Chancery Court that we were denied the right to do because we were denied a finding of proper purpose, even though we were at the Delaware Chancery Court at the instruction of the federal judge to craft an amended complaint, which is exactly what this court has been saying since the Walt Disney case is one of the reasons to use the tools at hand. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. Robert Saxon, Sullivan and Cromwell for the appellee.
Good morning.
Let me just begin by stating the rule below, what the decision below and the rule that it announced, which is not an extraordinary, broad-ranging, or novel rule, but in fact it's the correct rule, and it's a narrowly crafted rule, which is that a stockholder, a particular stockholder, not any stockholder, but the particular stockholder, making the demand lacks a proper purpose when he or she attempts to use 220 to investigate matters that the stockholder has himself or herself already put at issue in a plenary derivative action. There is no right.
Before you leave the rule.
Yes, sir.
And the application would be if a plaintiff's lawyer had two stockholder clients and sued in the name of, we'll say, client A, and the case is dismissed. Your understanding is that if the same lawyer wanted to bring a 220 action for shareholder B, that the Court of Chancery would have no problem in entertaining a 220 action by the same lawyer whose complaint was dismissed, brought on behalf of shareholder A.
Well, you've actually raised an interesting issue not presented by this precise case, but yes, Your Honor, the question is whether you're going to invite the sins of the lawyer on the particular client.
Well, whenever we decide a case, we have to come to grips with the implications of ruling in your favor. So that's a fairly significant point, because if you read the Court of Chancery's opinion, Court of Chancery seems to be as upset with the stockholder's attorney as they were with the stockholder.
Well, I think the stockholder's attorney is the one who's making the litigation decisions, and so in representative derivative actions like this, the decisions are largely made by attorneys, as we all know, as a practical matter, so perhaps some of the ire was directed to the attorney.
So what's
Let me answer your question. Let me answer it this way. Clearly, if a different lawyer and a different stockholder
Let me restate it, and you can answer it, then you can explain it.
Okay.
My question is, the same lawyer, different shareholder.
I think that's not compelled one way or another by this case. That's a policy judgment for this court to make as to how it wants to make that decision. If it wants to say that a lawyer who acts in this manner is disqualified the same way the shareholder would be, that could be your policy judgment to make.
Would you suggest that we decide that?
My view would be that you would disqualify the lawyer from representing another client because the lawyer can easily find another client to do it, and it's basically perpetuating and encouraging lawyers to engage in the type of improper complaint filing that occurred in this case. So I would urge you as a policy matter to say that it would apply to a lawyer as well as the client, the stockholder, but of course we're dealing with stockholder rights here, not lawyers' rights, and I think it's a policy decision that this court has to make, not a decision that's mandated as a matter of law one way or another.
Well, the Vice Chancellor's decision itself was made as a policy matter, was it not?
I think policy motivated.
I mean, he wasn't applying existing law. In effect, he made new law, did he not, in this particular case?
I don't believe that's correct, Your Honor.
You don't?
I do believe he applied existing law.
Mr. Sachs, how do you explain what happened in Disney? Where the complaint was dismissed, the dismissal was upheld, but this court directed the Court of Chancery to give the plaintiffs another opportunity to file a Section 220 action. If Vice Chancellor Strine's rule had been in effect at that time, that result would have been impossible.
Actually, Your Honor, there are two answers to your question. The first is this court was not confronted with the particular issue that is being confronted with now, which is there a proper purpose when there has been an action filed? So the court wasn't being presented with or considering that issue. The second answer is that the court did not direct somebody to file a 220. The court pointed out that 220 is a remedy and left it to the Court of Chancery to determine whether...
Well, you're quibbling, I think, with... would you explain the expression? You're quibbling with direct. The court, I think, basically drew a roadmap, didn't force the plaintiff to resort to 220. But I would think that any lawyer that represented the plaintiff in that case that didn't follow that roadmap would have been foolhardy.
I agree with Your Honor that's correct, that somebody would have looked at that and said, I guess I should file a 220 and see what I get. But this court left it to the Court of Chancery to determine the issues of propriety and scope of any 220 request.
Isn't it correct that as of the time this case, this controversy began, the Delaware case law seemed to allow precisely what the plaintiff's counsel did here?
No, at the time of this case, we have Beezer, which had been decided before this case, Vice Chancellor Lamb, who had unequivocally said it does not allow it, and we had multiple encouragement from this court which said you should use 220 before you file a derivative action. And we had no case that said you may use 220 after you filed a derivative action. Understanding the context that existed in the Disney case, I fully appreciate that, but nobody had ever decided the issue. So
you have one case going one way, you have Disney going the other, and at most it may be anybody's guess.
No, I don't think that's a fair characterization. The one case to have actually been asked to decide the issue, the Beezer case with Vice Chancellor Lamb, decided it one way. You have Disney where implicitly there is discussion about pursuing a 220 after a derivative action has been filed, leaving it to the Chancery Court to decide whether to permit it or not without confronting the issue per se, and you have multiple decisions of this court saying 220 should be used as a tool at hand prior to filing a derivative action. That was the state of the law at the time this case was decided.
Well, how long would someone or would the plaintiff here be disqualified from filing a 220 demand?
They're not disqualified from filing a 220 demand. They lack a proper purpose to file a 220 demand for purposes of seeking information in order to enable them to circumvent Rule 23.1 and find information to plead an existing derivative action. That plaintiff could file a 220 demand for a different purpose. There's nothing in the ruling below that precludes that person, strips that person of their right to use 220 for a different purpose. The ruling below says only that it is not a proper purpose to use 220 after you have gone ahead and filed a derivative case.
So if this had been rephrased, that we want to investigate waste and mismanagement as opposed to demand futility, that would have been permissible?
It would be up to the court to determine whether what they were seeking to investigate was what they had already put at issue in their derivative case or whether they were seeking to investigate something different. So in this case, it was conceded that what they were seeking to investigate was the matters that had already been put at issue in the complaint in California. And let me pause. So there was no question about that here. But
I'm a little confused by that phrase because it was used in your opening, the very first sentence of your opening. The matter put in issue in California, I understood to be the merits. There was, the issue of whether or not the board would have been disqualified from making an objective decision, whether or not to pursue or cause the company to pursue the litigation was not put in issue.
I think it was put at issue in the California case. We had moved on demand to dismiss on failure to make.
I understand that, but your characterization. And there's a reason for this question, is that the plaintiff put that in issue. In fact, the thrust of your Rule 23-1 attack is that the plaintiff didn't put it in issue and should have. That is, there was nothing in the complaint that really addressed the Rule 21 issue. Here's my the reason for the question. Okay. If we were to rule in your client's favor,
yes,
then we would have to articulate a doctrine that could be used predictably by practitioners and litigants. And I'm struggling to figure out what exactly that rule would be.
Let me state it somewhat differently. A different statement, maybe the words at issue are the words that are have a meaning that is not intended certainly by me. But a different way to phrase it is, once a stockholder has filed a derivative action, access to information under 220 for purposes of that lawsuit is not a proper purpose.
Okay, and then the question I have is, why not? As a policy matter, as a matter of logic, you know, whatever.
It's a proper legal determination that is warranted, compelled as a matter of policy.
Okay, if you, and why is that?
Well, the policy embodied in the derivative action is a careful balancing of the rights of a board of directors to manage a corporation and the rights of a shareholder of that corporation. And this court has stressed the importance of the balance multiple times in describing the derivative framework. If you encourage people to file derivative actions without and just asserting a lack of demand and going forward and filing them, you are intruding upon the rights of the board to manage the corporation.
Well, let me ask you a hypothetical. And when we use the phrase tools at hand, Section 220 was one example of the tools at hand, but we also emphasize looking at filings with the SEC and other matters of public record. My hypothetical question is, if someone in good faith looks at the SEC filings and in absolute good faith firmly believes that they can withstand a motion to dismiss under Rule 23.1, but it turns out, notwithstanding their diligence and looking at the SEC filings, their complaint gets dismissed. Why shouldn't they get to file the 220 action?
Well, let me go at it. Well, the reason is because they made the election to bring their action without going for 220, without making a 220 demand. Now, you posit a situation where somebody in good faith thinks they have sufficient facts. The history and the practical reality that was indicated in this case, in the case that was not appealed, the Baca case that the same firm was involved in, what we confront day after day after day, what the Chancery Court confronts day after day, is a pleading that is a rush to the courthouse, and you get a slew of pleadings because of what happens. So you're positing one scenario. Why shouldn't they, under that scenario, get to file a 220? The answer is a different stockholder can do it. That stockholder made its election to initiate derivative litigation because it believed it was proper to do so. Having done so, 220 is not a remedy to circumvent Rule 23.1.
And but why aren't the alternative remedies discussed in the briefs equally effective?
What alternative remedies?
Of not letting the shareholder be the class representative, of not letting the shareholder's attorney be the lead counsel.
Honestly, as a practical matter, we've had those remedies in the courts, in the state courts, in the federal courts, in the courts of this state for years, and people don't get sanctioned for filing. I mean, it is the bar to sanction somebody for filing a complaint is extraordinary, and you're not going to get that.
No, I'm not talking about sanctioning them. I'm talking about
sanction.
It's a form of sanction.
Yes. But that's sort of a remedy to say you may not do this, you may not file this. You're not going to get consistency of treatment. And one thing that I think is important from a policy perspective is predictability. And Justice Jacobs pointed out, you want a predictable rule. You want a rule that everyone understands, and you want a rule that meets
the
purpose.
Well, help me understand the scope of this rule you're arguing for. You're saying another stockholder could file the 220 action. Does that stockholder have to opt out of the class?
This isn't a class action. This is a derivative action, so we're not dealing with a class in this particular case. The purpose of 220 is, and again, this court has said it, is to encourage thoroughly well-researched complaints. That's the reason you do it before you file the complaint. That's the reason this court wants to encourage. That's the reason the legislature wants to encourage it.
But that was the purpose of my hypothetical. My hypothetical assumed there was a thoroughly researched complaint based on SEC filings. And notwithstanding the fact that it was thoroughly researched based on information other than 220 information, it was dismissed. And even in your answer to my question, you were drawing a distinction between this complaint, which you characterize as not thoroughly researched, and a thoroughly researched complaint, which seems to indicate there would be problems with the application of the rule.
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. I think the proper application of the rule is once you make your election, that's when the rule kicks in. That's no longer a proper purpose. And so, again, like with any rule, there could be a situation like the one you posit where somebody did a good job, went forward, and it wasn't enough, and it didn't suffice. Now, let me point out, because we're omitting Rule 23.1, and the federal rule is just like the Chancery Court rule, and there's a reason for that rule, which is ordinarily you may not take discovery in order to plead demand futility.
Well, we're aware of that.
Okay,
let me ask you this, given the shortness of time. What the Vice Chancellor did was to import into Section 220 jurisprudence this concept of election, and you indeed are echoing that. But since we're talking about policy and reasons to why the court should come out the way that the Court of Chancery did, it's helpful to try to articulate that perhaps in terms that are more consistent with Section 220 jurisprudence, if any there are, and I'm not sure what those might be. For example, what the Vice Chancellor could have held was that having filed a derivative action, the court, plaintiff's attorney thereby represented to the court that this matter, this complaint had been adequately researched and pled facts sufficient to withstand a Rule 23.1 attack, and having done that, should be stopped from exercising what would be ordinarily a statutory right to seek relief under 220. That might be one way to do it, although it would import an equitable notion. Another way to do it would be at the Section 220 level, that is, if the plaintiff in this case comes into court, says we want to examine books and records to investigate possible wrongdoing and whatever else. The court could have said, yes, well, those may be proper purposes abstractly, but your real purpose here is to circumvent 220. Therefore, as a factual matter, you haven't established a proper purpose. Could have been done that way. It didn't happen that way either.
I think the word election, Your Honor, is just a way of phrasing, a phraseology, which is using 220 to take discovery in an existing litigation is not a proper purpose under 220. That's the way I would frame it in terms of 220 language. So you don't have to call it an election, but if your purpose as articulated is, or as found, whether articulated or not, by the court to be, to take discovery for a derivative litigation you have filed, that is not a proper purpose under 220. You don't have to call it an election. As a practical effect, what is doing is defining what is or is not a proper purpose under Section 220.
One last question, for me at least. Given ambiguous, if not confused, state of the law at the time this Section 220 action was filed, I know you don't agree with that premise, would it be fair, even if we were to agree with your legal argument, to have it apply in this case where the law was, went in several directions?
It would be, Your Honor, and it, as a practical matter, it doesn't matter, because this plaintiff went ahead and filed yet another complaint, didn't ask for a stay, didn't ask for discovery from Judge Patel, could have asked, didn't ask for discovery, and that complaint has now been dismissed with prejudice. So this plaintiff has no rights any longer because it's lost on the merits with prejudice. And that matter is now up in the Ninth Circuit, as Ms. Scott said. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just want to make two points, if I can. One on predictability. I think that there can be a bright-line test that is predictable, and that is if there is a complaint that is validly in action under the Braddock definition in federal court or in Delaware court, 220 is not available to that plaintiff because that plaintiff has other avenues available or has foreclosed from 220. Where there is no complaint validly in issue under the Braddock definition, so that the plaintiff has to request, has to analyze demand futility under the new board, then it's a clean slate. There is no complaint pending, and 220 should be available to craft a new complaint, just as it has been under the precedent of this court, Disney, Ash. And as far as remedies, the rush to the courthouse, which I think is a bit of an urban legend, as Judge Chancellor Chandler called it, but to the extent that there's some validity, because it is one of the factors to consider and lead in deciding who's the lead plaintiff and who's the lead counsel, then those questions should properly be best addressed by the court who's handling the plenary action. Either make the person lead who has a better pleading, who maybe did 220 and came in with a better pleading, which nobody did in this case, even though the lead counsel position was decided about 5 months after the filing, and somebody could have. Nobody did. Or if you've made a lead counsel position and lead plaintiff and you decided that they're wrong, then withdraw it or dismiss the complaint with prejudice, as this court has done in White versus Panic and said, could have been a case, but it's dismissed with prejudice. There's a lot of remedies available other than foreclosing Section 220, which is a very valid tool at hand, and it's a tool that should be allowed to plaintiffs from wherever they come around the country as well as Delaware.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I wasn't going to interrupt your sentence, but you did have a lot of ors in the last one. But when you got to there, I knew that you had inserted a period. So time is up.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Thank you both. The court will take the matter under advisement and will take a brief recess.